glow. Get from out the road when he get dough, it's horrible. Time is money, spend, wait, save, invest, affest. The 10K, so cave a chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all are dumb and get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he bout to change the price again. And go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, albums shrilling in fear. And won't stop top billing till he a gazillionaire. Took a Jehovah money for an Arabic Torah. Charged in advance, translated and ignored us, sorta.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Amit Narang, who is Public Citizens Regulatory Policy Advocate and the editor of the Administrative Law Review, a widely circulated legal journal focused on regulatory law and policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amit Narang.
Thank you very much, Ian, for having me on.
And under the radar, lawmakers are pushing a bill that would curb the influence of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, and the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, all in the name of reform. Of course, by and large, most of these pernicious bills are aimed at reform, are they not? But I take it your analysis indicates quite the opposite.
Well, that's right. The so-called reforms to the financial reform law that are being offered in Congress by Republicans have often taken the form of further delay, further analysis of so-called costs and benefits of financial reform, despite the obvious benefit of avoiding the next massive financial collapse. So these are reforms in name only.
But since Dodd-Frank was first floated, if you will, it's been under assault. And there have been relentless efforts by the banking lobby to water it down. And this appears to be the latest one with this Senate bill authored by Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, and Susan Collin, Republican of Maine, and also with the support of the Democrat Mark Warner of Virginia. I take it that by sending this or assigning this bill to the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs, which is overseen by Joseph Lieberman, they think they've got a way to fast-track it into law. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. What's very different about this piece of legislation is that it's being considered, seriously considered, in the Senate first rather than the House. We've seen quite a few Dodd-Frank slowdown or shutdown bills in the House that have passed easily, frankly, but have gone nowhere in the Senate. This time it's the opposite. There's a chance that this bill will pass in the Senate first, and then we know that passage in the House is a foregone conclusion. As of this date, over two-thirds of the financial reforms supposed to be instituted under Dodd-Frank have not been established. That's 2.5 years after the law was passed and almost 4 years after the financial crisis itself. And this bill is only going to add further delays and also present the potential for a future White House that is opposed to financial reform or opposed to particular agencies. I'll use the CFPB as an example, since they've been fairly controversial in some quarters since their inception. It allows a future White House the tools to effectively shut down the remaining Dodd-Frank rules to be implemented.
But it seems to be the tactic that's used, even though it's all being couched under the rubric of reform, the tactic is to open the door for legal challenges, isn't it? That's what happened at the Consumer CFTC, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Didn't they basically sue the CFTC into a dead halt?
That's right. The financial industry has been very active suing the financial agencies, the CFTC, but also the SEC, potentially in the future the CFPB, for on the basis of their rules not being adequately justified on the basis of the rules' costs and benefits. So basically what industry is saying is that the cost of these financial reforms to regulated industries, i.e. the financial industry, outweighs the benefit to the public. And it's disappointing to see that this rhetoric, but also these legal cases, have gained quite a bit of traction. They've already netted one victory in court, and it's only spawned more lawsuits. What this bill capitalizes on the cost-benefit attacks on financial reform, it basically allows a future White House to say to one of these independent financial agencies, your cost-benefit analysis on any particular regulation is wrong, and you have a couple of options. You can either go back to the drawing board with your cost-benefit analysis, you can withdraw your rule, or you can go ahead and finalize the rule despite our assessment that you've done a bad job with the cost-benefit analysis. The problem for the agency, if they want to go ahead and finalize a rule, is that they're going to be submitted to the same kind of lawsuit that they've already seen. And this time, they have a White House, they have a strong piece of evidence in a White House assessment that an agency has done a bad job of cost-benefit analysis. And, for many, cost-benefit analysis seems to be a useful tool in theory. What we see is that in practice, it's far less useful and is a very dangerous concept to use in justifying regulations. I can give you a good recent example, if you'd like.
Go ahead.
Recently, the Federal Aviation Administration tried to finalize a safety regulation where they limited their pilots from being in the air for too many hours, basically. They wanted to have some time duty limits. And when the White House reviewed the economic analyses underlying the rule, they said, well, for commercial pilots, this seems fine. But for cargo pilots, we don't think this regulation is necessary. And they said that the costs and the benefits in that case did not justify the rule. Basically, what they said is that the benefits of avoiding a crash for cargo pilots were too low because there hadn't been that many incidences of cargo fatalities. And the fact that cargo planes carry mostly cargo and very few human lives would mean that the human lives lost in a cargo plane crash would be lower, so the benefits would be lower, and in that case don't justify the costs. It's a pretty striking example, I think, of the flawed approach to justifying safety regulations on the basis of cost-benefit.
Well, that reform, though, the real reform in the FAA came as a result of a plane crash in upstate New York where the pilots had been working too long hours. And the idea that the aviation industry could step in and change rules that impact human life in that cynical way is pretty breathtaking, I must admit. Again, I'm speaking with Amit Narang, who's Public Citizens Regulatory Policy Advocate and the editor of the Administrative Law Review, a widely circulated legal journal focusing on regulatory law and policy. And we're talking about efforts to undermine the Dodd-Frank Act, most of which has still been stalled since it passed a couple of years ago. And this latest assault comes from a group of senators led by Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, and Democrat Mark Warner of Virginia. They're pushing the bill through the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs, overseen by Joseph Lieberman. And what's also extraordinary about this, Amit, is that the Congress has balked before granting the White House such authority as this bill indicates. It's almost like a reflex on the part of the Congress not to give the White House that kind of power. So the idea that they're handing this power over flies in the face of the logic of the separation of powers, doesn't it?
That's right. Congress has traditionally jealously guarded oversight of independent agencies and, push back against attempts to expand that influence to the White House. Even Senator Susan Collins herself in 2009 in a hearing expressed strong reservations about any kind of legislative proposal that would allow the White House to review independent agency regulations and their economic analyses in particular. So it's surprising that in just a few short years, Senator Collins has done a 180 on this particular issue.
So what explains this? Is this all about the power of the banking lobby, Amit Narang?
I'd say so. I mean, this bill is a recipe for, preservation of the status quo on Wall Street, which is basically Wall Street policing itself, regulating itself. Like I said, over two-thirds of financial reform has yet to be put in place. And so the kind of self-regulation that reigned on Wall Street before the financial collapse largely still reigns, and we know what kind of effect that had on Main Street.
So how do they sell it to these legislators, assuming that they're not totally corrupt and completely in the pocket of the Wall Street banking lobby? I mean, what are their arguments, or is this purely a case of quid pro quo? You know, we give you a campaign money and you give us what we want.
Well, one trick they use is to try to bury the impact on particular financial agencies and on Wall Street reform specifically. Nobody is calling this, you know, the Wall Street slowdown or shutdown bill. They are arguing that this will bring, you know, better metrics for agencies to use when they put forward regulations. But it should be noted that nobody is arguing that this is going to speed up or expedite the process of getting these overdue financial reforms in place. This is definitely a case of putting additional burdens on agencies, financial agencies, trying to implement what Congress wants them to do, which is financial reform in the wake of the Wall Street economic collapse. You know, in this instance, we're seeing a real effort to use the term or use the phrase job-killing regulations to hide a very specific agenda to roll back much-needed financial reforms.
Again, I'm speaking with Amit Narang, Public Citizens Regulatory Policy Advocate and the editor of the Administrative Law Review, a widely circulated legal journal focusing on regulatory law and policy. Well, we've seen the assault from day one against the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and efforts on the part of Congress to not allow its newly appointed head to have the authority that was necessary. Another trick, you know, I guess under the rubric of the fine print, all in the name of reform, was the idea that they wanted to make it more like the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, which is a 5-member board, as opposed to having a kind of czar, if you will, in charge who can actually get things done. That seems to be another trick they use. I'm just surprised that the public aren't more outraged at these shenanigans, which really, given the extent to which the taxpayer made these bankers whole, and now they're bigger and more powerful than ever. And meanwhile, as we can tell from the election narrative that's going on now, Main Street is not whole, and Main Street's hurting, Wall Street's rolling in dough, and it's just an obscene situation. And I'm just amazed that I'm glad that you and Public Citizens are shining a light on this, but I just don't get the impression that there's sufficient scrutiny going on of this kind of mendacity.
The public should be outraged. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is, you know, a common sense financial agency in the best interest of protecting consumer interests with respect to financial products. These are complicated products. Consumers were being taken advantage of wholesale before the financial crisis. Abusive and deceptive practices by credit card companies, by mortgage lenders, were taking place across the country. And so the need for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and their reforms is greater than ever. The outlandish claims that the Bureau would act like a czar were much overblown, and the fact is that if this legislation passes, the czar is going to be in the White House overseeing the Bureau, not at the Bureau imposing, you know, burdens on the public, as many will claim. You know, I'm with you on this one, Ian. I don't see how you can make a strong case against the common sense financial protections and a common sense agency that's acting in the best interest for the first time on behalf of, you know, financial consumers for financial products.
So given that this is unusual, this bill is being generated in the Senate, and the House will rubber stamp it because they have done everything they could to undermine Dodd-Frank from day one. What's likely to happen then if they do pass it? And what will the president do? Because last spring, the president signed the so-called Jobs Act, Jumpstart Our Business Startups. And I interviewed a number of analysts at the time about that, and they said this thing was just an absolute outrage. It was full of it was an invitation to fraud, where all kinds of flim-flam public offerings could even be done over the internet, you know? And why did Obama pass that? And is he likely to veto this thing if it gets into law?
You're very right that the Jobs Act provides the kind of template for what we're most concerned about in this case. We definitely don't want a Jobs Act redux. I think that there is a certain degree of buyer's remorse also with the Jobs Act that shouldn't be overlooked. In this case, you know, we feel that having the Senate approve this legislation on a bipartisan basis will make it very difficult for the president to oppose it. He would basically be out on his own. Now, he would have good reason to oppose it because one of his signature achievements, the Dodd-Frank financial reform law, would very much be in jeopardy, along with the CFPB, which is, you know, another signature achievement, rightly so, of the administration. But it's hard to see a bill potentially passing the Senate as an amendment potentially on some must-pass piece of legislation during the lame duck session. That's really what we're worried about here the most. It's hard to see that bill being vetoed by the president, but we very much hope the president would be in a position to do that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Amit Narang.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Amit Narang, who is the Public Citizens Regulatory Policy Advocate and editor of the Administrative Law Review, a widely circulated legal journal focusing on regulatory law and policy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.